I'm Linda Huang. This is number 0408, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0408. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Joe McLean, who is an indie filmmaker. His latest is called The Drama Club, but he's also speaking out on the plight of indie filmmaking with a recent article he wrote.
We are constantly told as indie filmmakers by everybody around us not to divulge information. In fact, a lot of that stuff is even put into the contracts. Like, I'm not allowed to say how much money a specific distributor earns or how much they take for advertising, and I'm not allowed to let that information be public because then they are afraid that other movies will have to be paid the same amount of money. But if we keep that information to ourselves, it becomes super hard for us to do show business as a business.
Gerald Leonard, author of Culture is the Base, talks about how Uber should deal with its current series of scandals.
It starts off with the values of the company. So one, I would find out, what are their values? What do they believe are the true elements that makes them as a company who they are, and as a people who they are? To identify what those values are, make sure that they align to where you're trying to take the company, and then use those values. Put those values in a place where people are living by those principles and they're being guided by those principles. And if they're not, then they may not be a part of our organization because they're not living according to the values.
Ernie Smith from Tedium is back, this time to talk about the history of straws.
The real story here starts probably the latter half of the 19th century. At this time, straws were in use, but they were not the plastic straws that we're used to. Instead, they were actual physical straws made out of rye, basically ryegrass straws that happened to be tubular, so as a result, you can drink out of them.
And there's lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0408 was Linda Wang, a digital strategist and Edmonton-based blogger. She's also the founder of the Edmonton International Cat Festival. Yes, you heard me right. The Edmonton International Cat Festival, the only event of its kind in North America. And I have to mention this. Linda was one of the many producers I had through the years when I anchored a television newscast, but she was by far the best. She was an excellent producer, even though she loves cats. Yeah. Maybe you should have her on the program at some point to talk about that cat festival. I don't know why, but I'm compelled to do that. Anyway, thank you very much, Linda, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. People can go to my website, by the way, at thestufffile.com, and find the links to Linda's various sites. Thank you once again, Linda, for doing the guest slate on a program that is fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? A porn actress is facing a domestic battery charge after allegedly punching her boyfriend in the face during a post-coital quarrel. According to investigators, Lauren K. Scott struck the victim Saturday in his Pinellas Park, Florida home. The man suffered a swollen lip with a cut during the confrontation. As detailed in the arrest affidavit, the 23-year-old Scott would not get off the phone after having sex with her boyfriend, who asked Scott to leave the residence. Scott, cops say, became upset and struck her boyfriend of 6 months in the face. Scott was arrested on a misdemeanor domestic battery charge and booked into the county jail. As noted on the arrest affidavit, Scott identified her employer as Porn Industry. She has starred in such videos as Slut Puppies 9, Anal Buffet 10, and Milkmaids. In a handwritten motion, Scott asked the judge for permission to travel to Los Angeles, where she reported that she lives with her husband, who is probably glad his wife has a boyfriend to take her aggression out on. By the way, are you, like me, curious to know if the number in Slut Puppies 9 represents the number of slut puppies within the movie, or is this the number of sequels in the series of films? And don't get me started on Anal Buffet 10. The mind just boggles. Anyway, according to the operators of New York City's Penthouse Executive Club, they're therapists, not strippers. That's the argument they came up with, creatively characterizing its dancers to avoid $3 million in back taxes. But the state's appeals board ruled against it in April. Penthouse had insisted that its performers were more akin to counselors for lonely men, and that the club's door charge was an untaxable fee for therapeutic health services. You know, somewhere out there is a lawyer who had to sign off on this cockamamie defense, and I honestly can't decide whether his clients are paying him too much or not enough. Okay, before the public buys Girl Scout cookies, Scout leaders pick them up on credit and distribute them to the girls to sell. Now, the troops pay for the cookies after they sell them. But according to Pike County, Kentucky prosecutor Rick Bartley, the process didn't get that far in the case of troop leader 26-year-old Leah Ann Vick. It looks like she picked up the cookies, and now she and the cookies have disappeared. Vick has at least 4 different addresses, and Bartley said people have been unable to contact her. There's a warrant out for her arrest, charging her with felony theft by unlawful taking. The cookies were worth about $15,000. Okay. So, how does one disappear with $15,000 worth of Girl Scout cookies? Is there a contraband cookie cabal out there that we don't know about? And, you know, even though she has all those sweet treats, it's still not enough to sweeten the heart of a woman who would steal from Girl Scouts. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, an elderly German man, unnamed in news reports, was fined the equivalent of $110 in May for terrorizing neighbors in the town of Hennef by violating a 2015 agreement to lower the sound of his pornographic videos. He demanded sympathy because of his hearing disability, arguing that if he wore headphones, he could not hear the doorbell or burglars and therefore would feel unsafe. Okay, let's pause here for a second. Any of you who have ever watched porn, please raise your hand right now if either your enjoyment of or understanding of the plot line was ever impeded by the lack of pithy dialogue, the pulsating porno backbeat music, or the occasional shrieks of encouragement and/or direction of the participants. I mean, are you wondering whether the girl looking for employment got the job, or the pool boy ever finished collecting the leaves, or what kind of tip that pizza delivery guy got? Anyway, this story gets better, by the way. At his May hearing, he objected to the characterization of the sex sounds were from videos on the day in question. He said he had a prostitute in the room. It was not porn, he insisted, confusingly. It was live. So, now we know, at least as far as he's concerned, porn can't be live. Okay, now I'm curious. Were the sounds the neighbors hearing from the prostitute or him? Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? The world of indie films can feature a rough journey. It's difficult to get a film made, difficult to get a film distributed, and sometimes difficult to reach an audience, no matter how good your movie is. Recently, I saw a fascinating article on The Wrap, which was written by Joe McLean. He tells the story of the financial journey of his first film, a sci-fi flick called Life Tracker. Joe joins us on the line via Skype from California. Hi, Joe.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on the program. Your first film is Life Tracker, but before we get to that, I just want to mention briefly, you've got one that's coming out right now.
Yeah, it was released on the 9th, so it's available on iTunes now. Please, go watch it.
And that film is?
It's The Drama Club.
The Drama Club. And as I mentioned, we're talking about your first film in a moment. Where is this in the canon of Joe McLean? Is this your second film, third film?
It's both. This is the second film. If I'm if I'm including things that I no longer wish to discuss because they were so long ago or so embarrassing, then maybe it's my third.
We have to find those embarrassing ones now. But let's get to the issue of talking about your first film, Life Tracker, which was, I said, a sci-fi film. As I said, you wrote a very interesting article in The Wrap, and you talk about the need to share how much money you raise and how much money you spent on this film. First of all, Why did you do this article?
Well, I did the article because we are constantly told as indie filmmakers by everybody around us not to divulge information. In fact, a lot of that stuff is even put into the contracts. Like, I'm not allowed to say how much money a specific distributor earns or how much they take for advertising and I'm not allowed to let that information be public because then they are afraid that other movies will have to be, will have to be paid the same amount of money. You know, they're always nervous about the next deal. But if we keep that information to ourselves, it becomes super hard for us to do show business as a business. If I don't know how many times my movie is streamed on Netflix, or if I don't know how much money per stream or per download my movie makes on Amazon or iTunes, then it becomes impossible for me to figure out what should the budget be of a film in order for me to conceivably make my money back and not go into debt.
Now, you went through this whole situation with your first film. Was it quite the learning process for you as you had the trials and tribulations of figuring out just where the money was going and more importantly, why wasn't any of it coming back in?
Yeah, I mean, it's just so secretive. When the movie was done, everybody that was between me and the viewer got to reach their hands in the pot before anything came back to me, which is how it's done. And there's not really a way that has been presented to the world to make this any better yet. I'm sure it will, but right now this is the model. The distributor and the sales agent, all of these people get to have a cut before it comes back to the creator.
Yeah. The problems and trials and tribulations of having any kind of success almost seems as difficult or ludicrous as the plot for Mel Brooks's The Producers, when you think about it.
Exactly. It's very true, because it's more about eyeballs than it is about the content of your movie. Right now, my new movie, The Drama Club, we're struggling to stay on the front page. We're doing it, but the front page of the pre-order for iTunes. Because if it goes to the second page, if a viewer has to click one more button to see what's available, then less people will watch the movie. But if iTunes has it on their front page, more eyeballs see it, and we get a better return.
Okay, so what lessons have you learned in promoting the new film you have coming out called The Drama Club? What have you learned because of the experience you had on Life Tracker?
So it's been a different animal, because in Life Tracker, I had some recognizable names and faces in the cast. And I even had a professional sports star as one of our executive producers. So people were more interested in giving us press. The Hollywood Reporter and Variety and MSN and all these people came to our set. They announced the production. They gave us reviews. And it was just because these people were involved. My new movie doesn't have that. So the reason you're talking to me now is because I wrote this article for The Wrap. So I didn't have a celebrity face involved with the new movie. So the only way I have been able to get any press to touch us is to be able to write content for another website or for an industry news site, and then sort of slip in a plug for my movie in the back end.
Well, let's mention it again. The Drama Club is your new movie. We want to get that out there as many times as we can. That's the important thing. But going back to Life Tracker, you had a celebrity, sports celebrity, who was part of your funding. Give us a little bit about that. Who was in the movie? Who that funder was? And it was a sci-fi film.
Matt,
so let's share that.
Matt Dallas, the actor from ABC's Kyle XY, was one of the stars of the movie, and he has got like a very loyal science fiction fan base, now has actually a very popular YouTube channel and web series there. But then we had an NBA star, Baron Davis, invest some of his own money into the film as well. So the first money you get is always the hardest money to get. But once you have that first initial investment, the next investor says, well, this person obviously had enough faith in you. So maybe I have to worry a little bit less.
Do you think distributors, those who you go to try and sell your movie, do you think they look at you as a business, as somebody that they can make money with, or someone they can exploit? In other words, I'm sure a lot of, especially young indie filmmakers, they think of their first film, their second film as calling cards to bigger and better things down the road, and sometimes they're taken advantage of because of that.
I agree, but it is a mutually beneficial exploitive relationship. I need the eyeballs that these distribution companies can get me that I cannot get on my own. It would be an even bigger failure for me personally right now, because I don't have the bankroll to advertise my movie. It would be a bigger failure with less eyeballs to release the Drama Club if I did it on my own. So I need them, and yes, they want to make money off of me. I'm confident that the people that are the main reason for distributing them for any movie is money. They're in the business side, I'm in the show side, and together we make up show business, and neither one can survive without the other.
One of the ways a filmmaker can get out there is to get themselves into various festivals, get to be seen that way, get their films to be reviewed, then hopefully they can get distribution. Now, sure. To a certain degree that you've done that with Life Tracker, has it paved a way or opened a door in any way, shape, or form for your new film, The Drama Club? Have you gone back to some of the same distributors and said, look, you took my first movie, here's the second one? Has that helped at all?
That is how we got distribution for the second movie. And you know what? Making the first movie gives people – everybody in the business knows how impossibly hard it is to get any movie made at all. So if you are a first-time filmmaker that's never done anything, people look at you with a lot more inquisitive looks. So now that I've got one under my belt, even if someone hasn't seen it or has no idea whether it's even good or not – if they see that I've made another feature that got distribution and had some recognizable talent involved, they will automatically give me more attention and more time because they know that I've at least been through it once.
Again, I found the article very interesting. I think more people should get a chance to read it and understand the situation, because here you are, you're a filmmaker. This is your craft. This is what you want to do. You had to raise $150,000 for your first film. Making movies is not a cheap proposition, and if you can't find a way to turn a profit on it, that can be detrimental. What is the budget for your current one that is coming out, The Drama Club?
Much, much smaller, $67,000. And that's because I didn't have those names attached to me. And when I went back to my original investors, they all lost money on my first movie. So they gave me less, which is understandable.
Is it a disheartening process for you to go through, or are you still psyched by the process of making your film and getting your vision and your passion out there?
The excitement's the only thing that draws or that pushes me, because I'm not making a ton of money, so I've got to have that passion and that drive, or nothing would get done. However, I am in the spot right now, the same spot I've had after every movie I've done, whether it's a short film or a feature film. At the very end, right, you know, here I am sitting at the end of 2 years on The Drama Club from script to release, and now I'm going, how the hell am I ever going to get that kind of money again to do another feature? And it feels like it'll never happen again. However, I've got the track record, and that pushes me to know, okay, I've done it before, I can do it again. We just have to keep up the good fight.
Okay, we have less than a minute to go. I'm going to put in a link so that people can find that story that you did on your first film, Life Tracker. And, of course, we'll put a link in to your iTunes page. But tell us what The Drama Club is about so that people can look for it.
The Drama Club is about a group of friends that get together after 20 years of seeing one another. They made a pact in high school to meet each other at this place that they used to go vacation. And they all have this sort of – they're all in midlife crisis state. You know, they're all trying to recapture that those younger years, and the drama hits the fan.
can we call it the big chill for the millennials?
It is. I wouldn't call myself a millennial, but it specifically talks to that generation stuck between Generation X and the millennials. Like I heard it once described as, if you were someone that was old enough to love Nirvana but not old enough to go to a concert, you are screwed. You're stuck in this middle ground, and that's where the characters in my movie land.
The movie is The Drama Club. The filmmaker is Joe McLean. Joe, thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you.
Filmmaker Joe McLean. His new indie movie is called The Drama Club. You can find it on iTunes. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0408, and you'll find links to Joe's website, plus the iTunes link where you can find his latest movie, and I've also put in the link to that story he wrote on The Wrap about the plight of indie filmmakers and divulging what it costs to make their movies. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File Program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. Here's a penny for your thoughts from the Stuff File Program, coming to you from Montreal, Canada, a country that doesn't have pennies.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about some of the scandals that have plagued Uber and how they could get past this. Plus, Ernie Smith from Tedium talks about the history of the straw. We also have an idiot of the day coming your way and lots more Stuff File news on a program that is also fan-funded radio and listener-supported and depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, a New Jersey woman, distracted by her cell phone, was hospitalized after she fell over open basement access doors and fell 6 feet into the opening. Surveillance video captured the woman as she walked along a Plainfield street. The 67-year-old landed in the cellar of Acme Windows, where workers were repairing gas lines. Martin Delgadillo told WNBC-TV in New York that he was standing outside his barbershop on Somerset Street when he saw the woman plunge through the access door. She was looking at her phone. The last minute, she hit the door and fell right in, Martin said. The woman, whose name was not released, was taken to a hospital. Police say her injuries were not life-threatening. I thought texting and driving was a bad thing, Martin said. Now it's texting and walking. Okay, those of you who listen regularly to the Stuff File program know that I really do not have sympathy for people who do dumb things while texting. But this story is particularly funny because of the company whose basement she fell into. As I mentioned, it's called Acme Windows. You'd think that with everyone having watched years of Roadrunner cartoons, we'd all give anything named Acme a wide berth. By the way, if you go to the Stuff File fan page on Facebook, you can see the link to this story and also the video of her going, you know, as the saying goes, ass over tea kettle, into the basement of this establishment. It's quite the hoot. Anyway, moving right along, Lilo, a Swedish upmarket sex toys brand, has a warehouse in Las Vegas, Nevada. Now, during the Memorial Day weekend, burglars broke into the warehouse to load up on products. About $9,000 worth of merchandise was stolen, Lilo says. Security camera footage shows the men actually broke out the back window of their own pickup truck to fit more merchandise into the vehicle. The next day, there was another break-in. It is unclear whether it's the same two men. This time, they stole 30,000 condoms. Now, I love this story because of the quote from the company itself that they posted online. Here's the quote. One hopes that they stole these condoms, got into a time machine, went back 18 to 25 years, by the looks of it, and presented them all to their own fathers. Yes, that's rich, isn't it? Now, that's a classic quote. It also presumes that they have an idea who their fathers were. Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Carl Webb and his wife got into their car to leave Barbecue Fest in Memphis, Tennessee. 14 miles down the road, a police officer pulled them over. The officer came up and said, "Mister, are you aware there's a body on your trunk?" And that did not register, Webb said. He goes, "Mister, I'm not messing with you. There's a body on your trunk." So I got out. We walked around, and sure enough, there he was, still hanging on, still unconscious, just lying there. The unidentified man was sleeping on Webb's 14-inch wide trunk so soundly that officers had to wake him. According to Webb, the man was so drunk he started to stumble into traffic until the officer grabbed him. I hope he takes a good look at where he put himself and the hazard that he had opened himself up to, Webb said. It would have been death. There is no word on the man's name or if he's been charged with anything. They should check the files for a missing man named Van Winkle. I mean, I've seen pictures of this guy sleeping on the trunk. In fact, I posted a version of the story on the Stuff File fan page in Facebook. What I really need to know is how slow was Carl driving for the 14 miles that prevented this guy from just sliding off? And also, at no time during the 14-mile drive did he not look in his rearview mirror at least once? I mean, how could you miss a guy sleeping on your trunk? Wow. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Uber is now known just as much for its scandals as it is for its cheap rides. Why do things continue to go terribly wrong at the San Francisco ride-sharing company, whose CEO was recently caught on camera in a heated argument over money with one of his drivers? Gerald Leonard, a Washington, D.C.-based consultant on corporate culture, says you don't have to be a fan or critic of Uber to learn from its mistakes. Gerald is the author of Culture is the Base, 7 Principles for Developing a Culture That Works. He joins us via Skype from Washington. Hi, Gerald.
Hey, how are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for taking the time to be on the program with us. So,
not a problem.
We see companies having situations where they're just having bad PR incidents. Recently on the program, we talked about another one just last week, the situation that's been following United Airlines for the last little while. Now we're hearing Uber. Now we're hearing about Uber. So, what's the situation? What would you do as someone who is in the corporate culture and as a consultant? What would you do to help correct the problems that Uber seems to keep stepping into?
Well, I think it starts off with not only just them having a great vision for their company, but it starts off with their values of the company. So one, I would find out what are their values? What do they believe are the true elements that makes them as a company who they are and as a people who they are? And to identify what those values are, make sure that they align to where you're trying to take the company, and then use those values. Put those values in a place where people are living by those principles and they're being guided by those principles. And if they're not, then they may not be a part of our organization because they're not living according to the values.
Do you think part of the problem is that the folks at Uber almost perceive themselves as giant killers? I mean, you know, for a lot of the places they've walked into, they have upset the apple cart when it comes to the taxi industry, which, for lack of a better term, many people have seen as a monopoly, and they're becoming the way that people are getting around nowadays, to the detriment of taxi companies who have been around for, in some cases, almost a century. So is the fact that they're sort of like giant killers giving them maybe a false sense of bravado?
Well, here's what I think. Disruption is going to happen, especially with mobile technology and the way technology and processes are moving. Disruption is going to happen in major industries across the world. However, we don't have to be arrogant when we're in an area where we know we have a disruptive technology. Again, if we have a set of guiding principles, integrity, respect for our fellow men, a win-win scenario, and even if we, with that disruptive technology, where we may see ourselves putting others out of business, if you will, it doesn't mean that we have to be mean-spirited. It's kind of like Google. Google was disruptive, but they also have a value that says, do no evil. And so although they are disrupting the way things are done, they're also doing them in a respectful way and have become an admired company because of that.
You mentioned technology. One of the things that, of course, changes everyone's life as far as technology is concerned is social media. Could that be part of Uber's problem? And the reason why I bring that up, I'm the tail end of the baby boom. That was the largest group of population that came along in centuries, literally. And when baby boomers came to age, there was almost the attitude of, here we are, get out of our way. And I could see the same thing happening with the current generation of tech giants or in that age group. The only difference is anything negative or bad they do is magnified because of social media.
Right. Now, social media does play a big part in it. But again, I go back to, what are their core values? Amazon uses social media. Nordstrom uses social media. Southwest Airlines uses social media. It doesn't mean that they have to be arrogant or push people over to get their point across. So to me, if you're living according to your values and using those as a standard for how do you hire, how do you manage your day-to-day, how do you even manage your social media, you're not going to run into the situations. So I think social media exposes what's going on, but it doesn't cause what's going on.
So if you were to walk into Uber's offices tomorrow and explain to them what's going wrong with the company, isn't part of the problem first they have to realize that they have a problem and they possibly need some help?
Yes, they definitely have to realize that they have a problem, and they have a major problem that is cascading throughout the organization because, again, their values may be on a plaque on a wall, but they're not something that they're living by. And obviously, there's more than just the values, and there's some practical things that they can be doing. The stories that they tell, their best practices, their environment, how they've structured their organization. There's a number of things that they could be doing, but it really starts off with their guiding principles and their values, which should be based on their vision of where they want to be as a company, the reputation they want to have, and how they want to be perceived from the outside.
Part of the problems they have as far as bad PR is concerned starts right literally at the very, very top with their CEO, who's been getting himself in the media for all the wrong reasons. Bad behavior at the top, and I'm not making any analogies here, but bad behavior at the top, doesn't that have a sort of trickle-down effect that kind of permeates the rest of the company?
Of course, because people listen to not only what you say, they watch what you do. You know, it's kind of like when you're a parent. You know, your kids don't imitate what you say. They imitate who you are and what you do. And so as a leader of a company, if you want the company to be respectful and have a win-win mentality and to treat their customers with respect, then you have to live that way and you have to treat the employees that way.
So what would you do if you walked in there to Uber and said, okay, we're going to turn your company around. They get your principles. They understand what you're trying to get across. What would you tell them to do to get it across to the people whom they want to serve as customers?
Well, I think they have to, one, make some strong decisions at the board level to determine who stays and who goes, or to make corrective actions on the leadership team to make sure that they're going to live by those values. Secondly, they need to communicate at all levels of the organization and on a consistent basis that these are our values and that they're going to live them. And they need to just come out and be straightforward with the community and with their customers about the mistakes they've made, what they're doing to turn them around, and then stick to their brand message.
Well, that first point you brought up, you said who should stay and who should go. Are you saying that someone should go?
Well, it depends on the board, and it depends on if that person is willing to change and live by the values that the organization is going to set. If they're going to continually create damage for the organization, then I think Uber has some serious things to think about.
Fascinating stuff indeed. We've got just a few more minutes. I want to talk a little bit about your book. Your book is called Culture is the Base, 7 Principles for Developing a Culture That Works. Who did you write the book for? Who are you trying to reach the most?
Well, I'm reaching out to business owners. I'm reaching out to program and project managers, people who are making major changes in organizations, because anytime you make a major change or even disruptive technology in an organization, you're changing the culture. It's not just about people, process, and technology and a procedure. It's about how are people getting work done and who's talking to whom, how are we relating as an organization. And those things are critical for change to happen, because change is happening all the time. We have to help our people digest the change that's happening and also be willing to accept that change to make that change effective.
especially with all these new companies that are starting up. And, you know, sometimes startups are like bulls in china shops. They have a goal as to what they want to do, and sometimes they don't see what there might be trashing on either side along the way. Are there some common mistakes you see happening with young companies that are starting up, or are these the same mistakes that have happened with all startups going back to the beginning of business?
Well, I think there are common mistakes. You know, when you have the mentality that you're not thinking win-win with your employees and with your customers, when you solicit feedback from your customers and your employees, but you don't put it into practice, when you're not living according to what you're saying that you're trying to live by, those are some serious common mistakes that really do hurt your reputation and hurt your business trying to get out of the gate.
Your book is called Culture is the Base. How can people find your book?
They can find me on my website, GeraldJLeonard.com, or PrinciplesOfExecution.com, and they can find the book on Amazon. I have it in paperback and on Kindle.
Gerald, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Gerald Leonard, author of Culture is the Base, 7 Principles for Developing a Culture that Works. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0408, and you'll find links to Gerald's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Information is power. So if you want information about what's done with one of the largest chunks of your paycheck, taxes, how do you get it? As someone who spent years sifting through government documents, I don't even know the best answer to that question. But fortunately, someone with a few billion dollars more than me wanted to know the same thing too, and he decided to do something about it. Steve Ballmer, the retired CEO of Microsoft, was helping his wife with some of her philanthropic efforts when he started thinking about what the government does with all of our money. There wasn't a single reliable source he could use to find out, so he decided to create one that the rest of us can use too. Let's be fair, creating a database that explains what the government really does with all our money is no easy task. But the nonpartisan website Ballmer developed, at a reported cost of $10 million, is one of the most useful tools I've ever seen for tracking and understanding government spending. You should check it out too. Learn more at centerforamericatv.org.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio that's finger-licking good, if you're into that sort of thing.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about the history of straws. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on. And, of course, much more Stuff File news here on a program that is also listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, do you want to know what happens when extremism meets diversity? You get stories like this one. 18-year-old Devin Arthurs started living with 3 guys, 21-year-old Brandon Russell, 22-year-old Jeremy Himmelman, and 18-year-old Andrew Onechuck. They all had values in common, neo-Nazi values. But Arthurs ended up killing 2 of them. Arthurs became a Muslim, and his roommates shockingly failed to respect his new faith. Arthurs led police to the men's Tampa Palms, Florida apartment, where officers found the surviving neo-Nazi, Russell, who served in the National Guard and had a framed picture of Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh weeping at his door. You see, hatred and bloodthirstiness may not be such a solid basis for friendship after all. And often, the enemy of your enemy might not be your friend, just another moron. Anyway, Disneyland visitors got more adventure than they bargained for when a flock of geese let go in flight, fouling the guests. Anaheim police and fire officials say 17 people, including 6 children, were hit by bird droppings just before 9 p.m. Friday. A hazardous materials team was sent to Main Street near the Sleeping Beauty Castle after a report that feces had been thrown on people. It was quickly determined the real culprit was a flock of geese flying overhead. Authorities say the smeared visitors were taken to a private restroom to clean up and were given clean clothes. Police reported that the guests were healthy and happy after the event. You know, somehow, I get the feeling Canada is going to be blamed for this. And by the way, this is one of the main reasons, if not the main reason, why I never, ever, ever eat meals outdoors. Ever. Ever. Anyway, we have time for one more Stuff All News story before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff All program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. 32-year-old Megan McGraw of Bradford, Maine, is the owner of Topless Cleaning, which offers semi-dressed house cleaning services. Now, McGraw was arrested, but not because of the nature of her business. She was caught, police say, shoplifting naughty underthings, which, police delicately noted in a Facebook post, contain much of what her business title promised to her customers. Now, McGraw might not be someone you'd want in your house anyway. Her rap sheet is 24 pages long and includes prior theft and robbery convictions. That, in fact, turned her misdemeanor theft into a felony, and she faces up to 5 years in prison, plus time for violating the bail conditions on her last arrest. And because of the nature of her business, you thought she had nothing to hide, right? Wrong. Anyway, let's get to our last guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Ernie Smith, the man behind the website and newsletter known as Tedium, which is subtitled The Dull Side of the Internet, is back on the program. Last time, we talked about the history of the lickable stamp. This time around, he's here to talk about a recent newsletter that took a look at the history of straws. Ernie joins us on the line via Skype from Virginia. Hi, Ernie.
Hey, how's it going?
Just tickety-boo. Nice to have you back on the program with us once again. You know, the thing I found very interesting about this particular article is, again, you seem to bring interesting facts about things that are somewhat mundane, but it made me think about something that, quite frankly, I really hadn't thought of, and that's the fact that, especially when it comes to the plastic straws, we've got an environmental problem on our hands here with all these straws that are out there.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think that one of the things that really kind of intrigues me and got me thinking about this a little bit is, you know, Starbucks, for example, they kind of use that straw, that green straw, as like sort of this strong branding for themselves. It's very prominent. Like it kind of speaks to the genesis of their brand. But when it comes down to it, like when we drink out of a straw, it's a maybe 15 minutes to an hour, depending on how fast you actually drink your beverage. That transaction is very short. Unlike the cup itself, in many cases, it's tough to recycle because, you know, the stakes are a little small with it, and it's not really easy for recyclers to work with compared to like the plastic cup.
So let's go back to what you were talking about in Tedium. You look at the history of the straw. So how far back are we going here?
You can go back very, very far, but I think that like the real story here starts probably the latter half of the 19th century. At this time, straws were in use, but they were not like the plastic straws that we're used to. Instead, they were actual physical straws made out of rye, basically ryegrass straws that happen to be tubular. So as a result, you can drink out of them.
Now, are we talking something that was mass-produced for the general population or something that people fashioned for themselves as a drinking implement?
I think that there was – I believe that there was actual, like, production of the straws, but it was, you know, the same kind of production that you might have of, like, your average vegetable, like, you know, an ear, corn, or what have you. It was not the same process that one would take to produce like a modern day straw. It basically was a crop of sorts almost.
I guess back then the first mass produced straws wouldn't have been plastic, but would have been paper, right?
Yes, that's correct. Basically the in the late 19th century, there was this guy named Marvin Stone. He traveled around a lot through his life. He served in the Civil War, and he actually worked in newspapers for a while. But by the latter half of the 19th century, he had moved into doing manufacturing in in the DC area. And he had an interest in tubular objects. He also had an interest in mint juleps, which are kind of a big drink in the DC area.
Gotcha. So he came. Is this another situation where necessity is the mother of invention? He liked mint juleps. He wanted to some way to drink it. He created the straw on a more mass production level.
Partly, I think that part of the issue with the straw was that he was using a rye straw with his julep, and he didn't like what the straw would do, which is basically it would disintegrate in your cup after a while. It would kind of affect the flavor of the julep, and it would leave a little sediment at the bottom of the glass. So, being a guy who's already interested in cylinder-shaped objects, one of the things that he had made at the time was cigarette holders, and he had also worked on a fountain pen holder. He basically took a sheet of paper, added some glue to it, and then kind of figured out the design a little bit. And then the bar that he went to in D.C., he actually handed them a bunch of them for his own personal use. People noticed that he had these. He had these straws that were better than the rye straws, and then he went to the patent office, and he happened to have a number of patents already because he was a manufacturer of things, and that was how we got the paper straw.
Now, in reading and tedium, you go on further to talk about some alternative materials being used for modern day straw design. What are some of them? I noticed one of them is bamboo.
Yeah. There's actually a little bit of a push to bring back some of the natural elements to straws. I mentioned a Kickstarter from a couple of years ago that actually involves somebody who's trying to bring back the rye straws. But also, what's interesting is that bamboo has become kind of a natural alternative to your traditional plastic straw, and it's actually, there's one company, Brush with Bamboo, that generally they make toothbrushes out of bamboo, but they also produce straws using the material.
Are these alternative materials being used, are these for disposable straws, or are these supposed to be reused?
In a lot of cases, they tend to be reusable straws. I cite examples of metal and glass straws, but there are also examples of ones that are disposable. One company that I bring up, for example, that I've actually run into on a day-to-day basis, like when I'm out and about and I'll go to a coffee shop, there's this company called Eco Products, and they actually produce a plastic-like substance out of corn. It's a biopolymer, and it's designed to be compostable versus what we have with plastic, which is, despite the fact that we only use it for 20 minutes, it lasts for however many millions of years.
Right. Is there a push, again, with the economy and all, not the economy, the ecosystem and all, is there a push to bring back the paper straw?
Yes, in fact, there is, and one of the things that I point out in the piece is that Ted Turner, he has a restaurant chain. It's called Ted's Montana Grill. He basically started this chain to kind of draw attention to the plight of the bison. He's obviously an environmentalist. This chain of restaurants, which he worked on with another known restaurateur, kind of took the approach of creating a restaurant around the bison to help ensure that it would never go extinct. But on top of that,
I'm assuming then that bison isn't on the menu.
It is on the menu, actually. It's
really?
It's actually sort of the key ingredient. Basically, what they're trying to do is they're trying to create an economic incentive for breeding the bison like they would the cow.
Okay, so we've gotten off case. So how does the straw come into play with his location?
Basically, with the Ted's Montana Grill, they tried to come up with a strategy to avoid the use of plastic wherever possible. And one of the And one of the key issues that they were running into with that was the straw. So the so his co-founder, George McCarroll Jr., he basically did a search on the internet and found that the company that that Marvin Stone had created way back when for the paper straws, it had actually sort of continued, like, you know, through a few mergers, you know, acquisitions, that sort of thing. But there was a descendant company that actually still had the equipment around. McCarroll got on the phone with a guy from the company. They got to talking, and they came up with an agreement to bring back the paper straw for this restaurant. And after a while, you know, it kind of slowly faded a little bit. But McCarroll, like, basically said, well, you know, if we're committed to this environmental thing, we gotta stick with it. So he called up the guy again after a couple of years of the restaurant being in operation, and the company apparently had changed its entire direction to, like, build more paper straws because there was a sudden interest in them as an environmental alternative to the plastic straw.
Hmm. So we've now come full circle, I guess.
Yeah. It's really fascinating in a way. If you take a look at the firm, it's called Aardvark Straws. They actually produce like bendable straws. They produce straws that will actually last in a drink. If you like leave a drink around and like leave the straw in there for an hour or two, it'll actually keep its composition, which was a much harder proposition back, you know, when they were using them 50 years ago. That's part of the reason why those straws actually went into disuse after a while.
All right. Fascinating stuff, as usual. People can read more information about the straw, everything they wanted to know about the straw and more, by going to Tedium. And they could also download or get your newsletter and read all the interesting stories that you have to offer. Thank you once again, Ernie, for being on the program with us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Ernie Smith, writer of the website and newsletter Tedium. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0408, and you'll find links to Ernie's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
He was looking for a ride to Hooters, but got a lift to jail instead. A Florida man was charged with misusing the 911 system when he called asking for a ride from sheriff's deputies to the local Hooters. 28-year-old Jonathan Clayton Hinkle allegedly told dispatchers that his elderly grandmother was suffering from a stroke in the Hooters parking lot in Merritt Island, and he needed help getting there to assist her. Hinkle then said that he was running to the eatery as fast as he could, but asked if a patrol car could be dispatched to give him a lift. Oh, don't take my word for it. Why don't you just enjoy the 911 audio goodness?
Is it your grandmother that needs assistance?
Yeah, it's my grandmother's car. She's old and she's...
Where is she at?
She's at Hooters.
She's at Hooters?
Yeah.
Okay, what's going on with her?
She's not able to see real well, and she's got a lot of things going on in her life. I was wondering if I could give you guys money just to get me up there to help her.
Well, what's going on with her?
Not she's old, and she's just old, and I need to be there. I'm running as fast as I can from South Merritt Island to try to make it to her. If you guys could...
Do you know why she's at Hooters? Do you know why she's there?
Yeah, she went to Hooters because she was going to Longhorn's to eat with my family, and her vehicle messed up. And I know this isn't like a serious emergency, but my grandma keeps having heart bypasses, and she's about to have a stroke.
Do you know she's having a stroke right now at all?
No, nothing like that. She just needs my help really bad.
Okay, did she call you?
Yeah. I'm running as fast as I can. Just call me back if officers can help me, please.
Okay.
Listen, I'm in a hurry. I'm running down Gordney Parkway, heading towards 7 in Sunoco.
Let me make sure this is clear. You need assistance getting over to Hooters so you can go help your grandmother.
Yes.
But at this time, yes, she doesn't need any medical assistance.
No.
Responding deputies were unable to locate Hinkle's grandmother after an extensive search of about an hour around the restaurant. 3 hours after the initial 911 call, deputies were able to locate Hinkle's grandmother. She stated in a sworn interview with deputies that she never called Hinkle to say that she was in distress or needed medical attention. Hinkle got his ride all right to the Brevard County Jail, where he was charged with misuse of the 911 system. And this, by the way, was his fourth offense. The sheriff's office is now seeking restitution from Hinkle in the amount of $222 for the manpower expended for his 911 call. Now, why, oh why, would you concoct such a ridiculous story about an ailing grandmother just so that you can get a ride to Hooters? Well, one reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0408. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0408. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check us out on Patreon.com, or you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Evolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded in iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. See you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. A tape of the preceding program will be sent to the Radio Hall of Fame, where it will be placed under the statue of Marconi, which is kind of wobbly.